So let me just welcome everyone once again. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to do a little learning with you tonight. As we've been doing, we're going to look at one particular commentator, talk about his background and his biography, and then zoom in to study his commentary on the Book of Ruth. Okay. And the commentary that I want to study with you tonight is the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is a big person and a big topic. Last week I felt pretty confident we could really, study a lot about Shabtai Bass in one session and get kind of a good picture for who he was and what he contributed. And you talk about the Vilna Gaon, so you could do a week, you could do a month, you could do a semester, you could do a year, and you'd just be scratching the surface for reasons that we'll talk about in just a few moments. I hope you'll accept that this is a kind of snapshot. As usual, have an ambitious agenda and want to try to pack in the time that we have together to give you the fullest flavor possible for who the Vilna Gaon was and why he's such an important personality in Jewish lore and Jewish history. I'll begin with just a kind of a state of the field. Okay, so the Vilna Gaon was born in 1720, died in 1797, and since 1797, people have been writing about him. People have been writing hagiographies and biographies and academic works, and we have a whole litany of works written about the Vilna Gaon since his passing in 1797. The first biography of Vilna Gaon was written toward the end of the 18th century by a man called Yehoshua Levine, also the name of my second son, no relation that I'm aware of, but of course I'm partial to that biography. Half jokingly, 1871 was the first biography, and many have been written since. I'll just mention two at the beginning of this talk. Maybe the most recent biography was written in the last 5 or 6 years, a book called The Genius by Eliyahu Stern, a graduate of Yeshiva College and now a professor of Jewish history at Yale. And that's a revised history of the Vilna Gaon, which uses a lot of the most current thinking and scholarship, and particularly scholarship around demography and what Vilna looked like and how the majority Jewish population of Vilna really made an environment for the Vilna Gaon to flourish in a way that was very different from, let's say, Mendelssohn, who's the kind of counterpoint in Stern's telling of it. I would say the most authoritative, in my humble opinion, the most authoritative biography, if you're going to buy one biography of the Vilna Gaon, is a book I put at the end of the source sheet, or at the end of the source sheet before the Megillah, called The Gaon. The Gaon was written the end of the 1990s, I believe, originally in Hebrew by a scholar named Emmanuel Etkis, and translated into English in 2002. And you could pick it up. It's available. It's a little pricey because it's an academic press, but you could pick it up on Amazon or used on eBay. A little dense, but also quite readable. And Emmanuel Etkis is the top. You can't do better than Emmanuel Etkis for 18th century Jewish history. I actually had the privilege of studying with him. I think it was the last time that he taught at Yeshiva University. He used to come as a visiting professor from time and again. So around 10 years ago, he was already emeritus at that time because they have a mandatory requirement in Israel. And he was a professor for many years, and I think is still emeritus at Hebrew University. So now I think he's already into his 80s, but I believe is still active. Towering scholar. And if he says it, so it's right, meaning I'm exaggerating, but only a little. You don't have to do too much interrogation. He's done the work. He knows the sources backwards and forwards. He knows the field backwards and forwards. And he literally wrote the book on this topic. And I'll say at the front, that a good portion of my conception of who the Vilna Gaon was is colored and heavily influenced by the by the work and the teaching of Professor Emmanuel Eckes. So to the Vilna Gaon. As I mentioned, he was born in 1720 and died in 1797. So we're squarely in the 18th century. Many of us over the course of our formal or informal Jewish education have surely heard legends, stories of the Vilna Gaon and his, let's say, extraordinary intellectual exploits and ability. Anyone ever hear a story they want to share about the Vilna Gaon? So they say the Vilna Gaon only slept 2 hours a night, or 2 hours in 24. From the age of four, he had mastered all of Tanakh. By the age of 10, he'd mastered all of Shas. As a six-year-old, he was already fielding questions from Torah giants. He was a wunderkind, a child prodigy. He blew everyone away from the earliest age. So we have a treasure trove of these legends and these stories. My uncle used to say, all of us can say Ashrei by heart. The Vilna Gaon could say Ashrei backwards. And you try saying Ashrei backwards. It's hard. So I'll just give you one. Kind of snippet, okay, from a student of the Vilna Gaon. And if I neglect to say this more fully, please remind me. But we have to define what it means to be a student of the Vilna Gaon. Okay, so stop me if I fail to mention what it means to be a student of the Vilna Gaon. There's a man called Rabbi Yisrael Shklov, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon. And he said that the Vilna Gaon always said that every person should know one Masechta of Shas by heart. Should know one Masechta of Shas by heart. Okay, so we're lucky if we know a Mishnah by heart. If we know 10 Mishnah, that's impressive. So to know an entire, right, like pick a Masechta, Yoma, Sukkah, Brachos, the whole thing by heart. So that was the expectation of his students. So Yisrael Shklov has this memory. He says one of the Vilna Gaon students once memorized Masechet Sukkah, and they were talking about it. So the Vilna Gaon was asking his student about this, and then source number one in your source sheet, he says, then our master opens his holy mouth and listens, as one who counts pearls, cutting the components of the tractate into tiny pieces. How many times it mentioned controversies between Tanaim and Amoraim, and how many times the halacha followed one or another of them, and how many sugyot and methods of halachic interpretation there are, and how many laws from the Tosafot and the Jerusalem Talmud and Sukkot that were unfit. And he listed the types of acceptable Sukkot mentioned in this tractate, and such was his mastery of the entire Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the entire Torah. So it wasn't just that he had recall, right? He had synthesis and context, right? So he didn't just memorize the Masechta, but it was all categorically organized, right, like an encyclopedia in his mind, and all instantly accessible at his fingertips. So what do we make of these stories, of these legends, some of which sound exaggerated or apocryphal? So Professor Eckes writes the following. He says, even if we assume that in the portrait before us there is some degree of exaggeration and idealization, we cannot avoid the conclusion that it expresses an encounter with a personality endowed with extraordinary intellectual abilities and psychic powers, right? As we like to say, they don't tell these stories about you and me. Okay, so, maybe they're 80% true, maybe they're 100% true. We're not in a position to say. But certainly the sum total, right, of these stories leave us with an impression that the Vilna Gaon was, once in a lifetime, once in a generation, once in a century, once in a millennium, just a kind of mind that we do not often encounter. Okay. So I'll say one more thing about his early years, just because I think it's fascinating. And as a historical footnote, this is the first time that the Vilna Gaon was ever mentioned in a book. Okay, for what that's worth. At the age of 35, the Vilna Gaon had no official position, but he was already back in Vilna by that time, studying and writing. And in 1755, the Vilna Gaon's 35, 1755 is a very important year in Jewish history. It marked the beginning of the Emden-Eibeschitz controversy. So if you were a student of Rabbi Schachter, so you heard him talk about the Emden-Eibeschitz controversy probably on more than one occasion. It's too big a topic to open up right now, but it was a controversy that engulfed the entirety of the Jewish people. Yonason Eibeschitz was the Gadol Hador. Yonason Eibeschitz was the greatest rabbi of his generation. He's 30 years older than the Vilna Gaon. Okay, he's born in 1690, and he's the greatest name in Judaism. Okay, and his students, he has students by the hundreds, by the thousands. Every great student of the next generation, every great rabbi of the next generation, was a student of Rabbi Yonason Eibeschitz. In 1755, Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonason Eibeschitz of being a Sabbatian, of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi proclaimed his messiahship in 1666, apostatized in 1667, was dead by 1676. He's been gone for 80 years. And Yaakov Emden is accusing Yonason Eibeschitz, not without evidence, accusing Yonason Eibeschitz of being a follower of a messianic pretender. And this rocks the entirety of the Jewish world. Much more to say about this for another time. Yonason Eibeschitz published one book in his own defense, a book called Luchot Edut. Okay, and I have it for you, an excerpt in source number two. So Yonason Eibeschitz wrote to other great rabbis and lay leaders throughout the land to defend him and to say that no, he's not a Sabbatian, he's really fine. So he writes to the Vilna Gaon, okay? The Vilna Gaon, again, 30 years his junior, with no official position. He's just a guy studying cloistered away in a Beis Medrash in Vilna. And Yonason Eibeschitz writes this way. He takes all the correspondence that he collects and he publishes them in this book, Luchot Edut. Here's what he writes, source number two. He says, Uchemo kein shalachti perushei de kimios. I sent, right, the whole subject, the whole issue at hand were five amulets that he wrote, which were supposedly Sabbatian in nature. And he says, I sent copies of them to Vilna. I heard there's one person there, right, who's so extraordinary. A chassid, kadosh. Vetahor me'or Yisrael, every possible encomium he throws in him, the pious and the holy and the pure, the light of Israel, kalul kol hachmos, who knows everything, he knows everything, charif ubaki below eser yadus bekneses moreno harav Eliyahu, right, asher nodati hilaso b'chol Poland and Berlin velisa. His reputation is worldwide. Everybody knows him, right? He's the sharpest and the smartest and the wisest, and on. And he asks the Vilna Gaon, "Will you exonerate me?" And the Vilna Gaon says, "I'm not going to get involved. Thank you so much for asking me." The Vilna Gaon almost never got involved in public controversies, with only one or two exceptions, which we'll come to. And he says, we're down the kapschus. The Mishnah Avo says you should give everyone the benefit of the doubt. So I'm not getting involved, but everyone knows Yonason Eibeschitz has a wonderful reputation. So I have no reason to doubt that he has a wonderful reputation. Okay, and very politically savvy, answer to this request. Thank you for asking me. I declined to participate, but he didn't use those words. He answered without answering. And his non-answer is, of course, an answer, but that's for another time. So at a young age, the Vilna Gaon went into exile for a number of years. It's a mystery. Some people went into self-imposed exile to atone for some, you know, private sin that they committed. Maybe they needed time to reflect or to meditate. No one really knows what it means that the Vilna Gaon went into exile. There's one theory. I didn't see any evidence for it, but I'll just mention it. Rav Goren, right, the former the head of the Israeli army, the rabbi of Tzahal, Rav Goren, said he heard from his father that there was a tradition that the Vilna Gaon was going around to visit libraries and Batei Medrash in Europe in search of manuscripts. Okay, and maybe we'll have a time to circle back to that in a few minutes. But the Vilna Gaon was certainly very interested in old manuscripts and textual emendations. Not the craziest theory in the world. We just, you know, if we had the sign-in sheets from the library in wherever he went, and you know, he signed in, that would help us. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that record just yet. So what do we mean when we say that the Vilna Gaon was a master of all disciplines? So he was a master of all disciplines in Torah. He was also a master of all disciplines in general, or what we would call secular wisdom. So including, mathematics, and he wrote a book on mathematics and astronomy and music and literature and on. We have a couple famous statements. I'll just share one with you. I didn't put it on the source sheet, but again from Yisrael Shklov, who was one of his students, he says, "I heard from the Gra that to the extent that a person is lacking in knowledge of secular subjects, he'll lack 100-fold in the wisdom of the Torah. For the Torah and secular knowledge are bound together. He commanded me to translate whatever possible of the secular subjects into our holy tongue." The Gra didn't speak other languages, right? He spoke Yiddish and he spoke Hebrew, but he wasn't, able to read texts in Greek or Latin, whatever the case may be. So there's a story from Reb Chaim of Elazhin that he wanted a Hebrew translation of Josephus. So again, He was interested in all of these other disciplines because Torah is paramount, but it was his staunch belief that it was not really possible to understand or appreciate Torah without a deep and thoroughgoing understanding of everything else. So you want to know the halachas of Sukkah, so you need to know mathematics, and you need to know geometry, and you want to learn Hilchos Nida, so you need to know anatomy, and you need to know biology, and so on and so forth. There's a wonderful line about his interest in music and his appreciation for what it means to understand music. Again, think this is the 18th century, right? For all we know, right, he was listening to tunes composed by Handel and Mozart, right? We don't know, but it certainly wouldn't have been unthinkable. So the Vilna Gaon published how many books in his lifetime? Anyone know how many books did he publish in his lifetime? Zero. He published nothing in his lifetime. He wrote extensively. The quantity and quality of his intellectual output is staggering and maybe unmatched in the rabbinic world. So we talk about somebody who writes a commentary on Shas, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, a commentary on the Mishnah, a commentary on Tanakh. So he wrote all of those things. He wrote, and we'll talk about the difference between a commentary and his emendations, but he wrote either commentaries or emendations to Tanakh, to the Medrash, to the Mishnah, to the Talmud Bavli, to the Talmud Yerushalmi, to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Mishnah Torah, to the Rush, to the Zohar, and half a dozen other mystical works. The Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist of the first rank. So the entirety of the Jewish canon was not just known to the Vilna Gaon, but he had comments and emendations, you know, about all of the above. I'll just say a word about emendations. The Vilna Gaon was very interested in making sure that the texts that we had were accurate, and he had no compunctions about, you know, throwing caution to the wind and saying, the text in front of us is wrong. Okay. And again, whether or not he was working from older manuscripts, we don't really know. But, you know, he did kind of the math, the Talmudic math in his head, because it was all at his fingertips. So, you know, he would just know that there's 17 versions of this particular Medrash, and this is the right one based on everything else I know about. So, you know, he's making an argument, not just based on the internal logic, you know, what looks better, the three lines in front of me. He's computing, right, what makes the best reading of this text based on every other, right, kind of run a computer, you know, a simulation with every other citation or reference to this text. So he's got them all, and he's doing the computing manually. And he amends, right, with the exception of Tanakh, which is perfect, he amends the entirety of the Jewish canon. So he goes through and says, right, all of Shas, right? And there we have, right? You can look in open up any Gemara, and there'll be the Hagos Hagra, his emendations. And he'll say, this word is right, this word is wrong, this is a correction, this is an error. And he does this for the entirety of the Jewish canon. It's unfathomable, right? How much he wrote and how much he annotated. Eliyahu Stern makes this observation. He's not the first, but he has a nice formulation. He says he functioned like a Rishon, like a medieval commentary, even though he's living in the 18th century. He's not interested in the Achronim. Everything else is a secondary text. The Talmud is the primary text, and that's all that matters. And he sees everything through that prism, right? Normally, if you live in the 18th century, so you're bound by the earlier commentaries, right? The 800 years of, you know, what came before. The Vilna Gaon didn't feel bound by anything or anyone. Eliyahu Stern does have a theory which is a little unique, in the sense that at least zooming in on the Vilna Gaon's commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, which is just notes. You have to be a master just to understand it, because he's not, right, he gives you almost nothing. It's just a comment. He'll say, look at Nedarim, Nun Dalet Amud Beis, and Tosfos. And you're supposed to figure out the question and the answer and the solution, right, just based on his, if you know it all by heart, right, it's very simple. Right? He wasn't writing for the uninitiated, he was writing for the initiated, and he didn't have the time or the interest in spelling it all out, because he was on to the next, note. So Eliyahu Stern, said he's interested in doing this because there's just a proliferation, there's an overabundance of opinions, and there's printing, and everybody has, you know, everybody and their uncle is writing a book and a commentary. So the Gra wants to kind of arrest that process and say, this is the truth, okay? And this is where it ends, and here is the final interpretation. And again, it requires its own, you know, semester to dig through that pile of commentaries and emendations. But that's important as well. Okay. Immanuel Etkes always likes to say that you should think of the Vilna Gaon based on the way he was described in his lifetime, which were two words. We call him the Gaon, but he was also described, ironically, as Hechasid. He was the intellectual master, but he was also the master of piety. And this was his whole kind of orientation to life. So he wasn't involved in communal affairs. He wasn't involved in politics. He said, I'm not interested. He kind of lived quiet, ascetic a life. And he just wanted to, you know, serve Hashem, and that was all he was. That was all he was interested in. So again, you can't say it often enough, but he had no official position his whole life, no official position. So I'll just circle back now. What does it mean to have a student, right? He never gave a shiur. He never taught a class. He never had a yeshiva where he had. So to be a student of the Vilna Gaon means every so often, you know, he'd crack the door open and say, you can come sit with me and I'll dictate some novelle, and you student, you know, can copy them down, see if you can keep up, right? Or you're welcome to ask a question every now and again. And that's what it means to be a student of the Vilna Gaon. So a student of the Vilna Gaon really means, right, that you study his texts and you follow his teachings. Okay. I can't talk about the Vilna Gaon without talking about his antagonism toward Hasidism. There were one or two times in his life where he made an exception to his general rule. His general rule was that he's not getting involved in communal affairs. When it came to Hasidism, he said, "I am getting involved in communal affairs." Okay, and in the 1770s, he went on an offensive against Hasidism. And he said, these people, these Hasidim, are sectarians. They are heretics. They need to be stopped. They need to be banished. They need to be banned. We'll create a cherem. You're not allowed to talk to them. You can't interact with them. Don't count them in a minyan. If someone is going down this path of Hasidism, so you need to kick them out of the community. Okay, they're dangerous and they are heretical. No one was more vociferous, and no one carried more weight, right, in their opinion about Hasidism. So why was he so opposed to Hasidism? So for one thing, Hasidim made changes to tefillah, and the Gra found that very objectionable. Second is that the Hasidim de-emphasized Torah study. One of the tenets of Hasidism was not everyone can be a Talmud Chacham, but you could still be close to Hashem, you know, through the Rebbe and through Simcha and through a good act. And not everyone has to devote all their time to learning. And the Vilna Gaon considered this to be a heretical thought. And he said, no Hasidism for me. Okay. And the interpretations of the Hasidim of the Zohar, the Gra also found totally objectionable, and he said this can't go on. The Frankists, who in the 1750s were like, you know, the Neo-Sabadians of the 18th century, were surely on the mind of the Vilna Gaon, as was the Sabadian movement writ large. And there's, you know, good reason to believe, Emmanuel Etkus makes this point, that the Vilna Gaon feared that Hasidism would somehow be a new form of Sabadianism, and nothing good was going to come of it. So this offensive lasted basically, you know, the better part of 30 years until the death of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon's opposition to Hasidism ultimately failed, right? And in the next generation, there was a reconciliation. Chaim of Volozhin, who was the heir to the legacy of the Vilna Gaon, opened things up and basically, you know, toned the rhetoric down and sought out reconciliation with the Hasidim. Let me say one more word about the Gra's legacy, and that has to do with his love for the land of Israel. There are two times where he set out for Israel. He never made it there for reasons that are not really known to us, but he encouraged his students to go there, and they did. And as a result, you'll know this if you visit Israel today, especially if you visit Jerusalem. So, you know, they'll always say there's a difference in, whether they put on tefillin, on Chol HaMoed, or a certain text of the davening. And you'll say, well, why did they do that? So, minhag HaGra. what does the Gra living in 18th century Vilna have to do with the way I put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed in Jerusalem in 2021? So the answer is, his students, again, his followers, in the 19th century, emigrated to Israel, and they became the dominant forces in life in what was then Palestine, and they led the Jewish community and sort of paved the path for the Jewish community over the course of the next 200 years. So when you got to Jerusalem in 2020, right, we set it up because it was the students of the Gra who brought their love of Zion, love of Israel, and you know, reified it by actually moving there and settling and creating a community, and they established the community based on the halachos and the outlook of the Vilna Gaon. Okay, for another time, the other legacy, of course, of the Vilna Gaon is the Balazhin Yeshiva, his student Reb Chaim of Balazhin a few years after the passing of the Vilna Gaon, you know, starts the Yeshiva of Balazhin, which becomes the prototype and the grandfather of the Yeshiva movement in the 19th century. Okay. So let me just say a word about the Vilna Gaon's commentary to Tanakh. And again, he didn't publish it. It's published by his children and his students. So and when it comes to all of the Gra's writings, there's sort of always an open question: how much of this is the Gra, and how much of this is the students and the children of the Gra? Who again, right? They don't have any other agenda necessarily, but we're seeing everything through a prism of the next generation. So we don't usually think of the Gra as a commentator to the Torah, but he's a commentator to the Torah. And his commentary is part Kabbalah, Sod and Remez and mysticism, and not really accessible to the average reader. And some of it is Pshat. He's really interested in Pshat. So I'll just give you a couple of quick examples, and then in the time remaining, I want to turn to his commentary on the Megillah. So if you have the source sheet, I'll just punch it into the chat one more time. If you have the source sheet, look at source number. Source number. Let's just do an easy one. Six. Okay. Source number six. We'll do 6, 7, and 8. So the Torah in Parshas Mishpatim tells us the halacha of a burglar. Someone breaks into your house. So if you think they might be breaking in and you're in mortal danger, so you can kill them preemptively, and you know that's considered self-defense. The psukim that articulate that are a little hard to read. So the Torah says, source number six, Im ba machteret imatze hagana v'ukav ames ein lo damim. The guy snuck in under the, he tunneled in under your house. So he broke into your house. So you can assume he's out to kill you. So if you act first and kill him, ein lo damim, you are not responsible. You didn't like commit a capital offense. That's not murder, that's self-defense. Verse number two, Im zarcha Hashem ashalav damim lo. But if the sun shone on him, then there's a different halacha. Then you are responsible. Shalem yishalem im ein lo v'nim kar b'gnevaso. Okay, he has to make restitution, etc. But the first half of the pasuk, if the sun shone on him, then you are responsible. Right? Ein lo damim, you're not responsible. Damim lo, you are responsible. So what does that mean? So Rashi says, based on the Medrash, the classic rabbinic interpretation of this verse, number seven, Ein ze elokimin mashal. This is like a metaphor. It says, Im baror lecha davar sheyesh lo v'shalom imcha kashemesh hazeh shehu shalom ba'olam. Like, what does it mean? The sun shone on him. It's a metaphor. Like, it's clear as day, right? We would say in an English idiom. It's so obvious. What's so obvious? It's so obvious that he wasn't out to kill you, right? He was just, just was after the money, but he never would have taken anyone's life. Kach pashut lecha she'ein ba'al harog afilu yamod ba'al mamon kenegdo kigon av ha'chovev ha'chotel lignov mamon ben. This is the father broke into the son's house because he was in debt and he needed the money. So It's not a thought in anyone's mind that the father would ever want to kill the son. It could never happen. No, it was purely a financial issue. So if it's clear as day, if it's clear as day that there's no mortal threat, so then you're not allowed to kill the burglar because there was no, right? You call the police, but don't kill him because, right, there was no mortal threat. That's not self-defense. That's the rabbinic interpretation of the pasuk. Source number 8, the Aderes Eliyahu, the parish of the Gra. He says, "Im zarcha shemesh bepashtei shebayom ein din machteres." He says, "No. We take the text literally. During the day, this halacha doesn't apply. This halacha applies only if it's under the cover of night and we can't tell what's going on. And then you take, you have to act in self-defense because it wasn't clear and you couldn't. If it's daylight, none of these halachas apply." Radical reinterpretation of the text. Okay. I'll give you just one more example from Tanakh, and then we'll look at his commentary on the Megillah. I'll just summarize it for you in source number 19. So we just had this, so that's why it was on my mind. In Parshas Emor, the Torah introduces to us the holidays. Source number 9. Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe l'Emor. We know these psukim by heart. Vaydaber al b'nei Yisrael v'martai lehem lo'adei Hashem asher tigrosam mikrei kodesh elahem lo'adei. So Hashem says to Moshe, tell the Jewish people about the holidays. Sheishes yamim tasem melacha v'yam ha'shvi shabbas shabbason mikra kodesh kol melacha lo sasu shabbas hi l'Hashem v'chol moshevoseichem. Pasuk Gimel, 6 days you'll work, and the seventh day is a day of rest, and you don't do... I thought we were talking about the holidays. We interrupt this program for a special message about Shabbos. What is going on? So the Gra says, amazing. Talk about radical reinterpretation of the text. He says, this is not talking about Shabbos. He says, 6 days, the seventh day, those are days of festivals. Those are holidays. He says, read the continuation of these psukim and you will discover that there are 7 holidays specified in our parsha. The first and the seventh day of Pesach, that's 2. 1 day of Shavuos, 1 day of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the first day of Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeres, 7 total. So he says on 6 of them, read the pasuk. He says, this is the Gra speaking, Sheishes yamim tasem malacha. On 6 of them, you have a dispensation. You can do some malacha, because if you need to make food on any of those other 6 holidays, you're allowed to. Cooking and carrying are allowed. But on the 7th holiday, Uvayom hashvi'i Shabbas Shabbason. What's Shabbas Shabbason? Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, you're not allowed to do any of those things. Kom lacha lo sasu. There are no dispensations on Yom Kippur. Shabbas hi l'Hashem b'chol moshevoseich. Radical reinterpretation of the psukim, right? And again, he has this sense of certainty and this sense of confidence that allows him to, what he says, uproot the explanation of Chazal. Now, he'll never disagree with the conclusion, right? If the halacha is the halacha, but he says, you want to read the pasuk? I'll tell you what the pasuk means. The halacha, the midrashic interpretation, rabbinic interpretation, right? That's fine, meaning we have a mesorah and that stays in place. But you want to know the pshat? I'll tell you the pshat. Okay? And that's how the Gra interprets Tanakh. Okay, in the time we have left, let me just give you a few snippets from the Megillah. To give you an appreciation for the Gra's interpretation of the Megillah. It's not entirely clear that the Gra wrote this parish to the Megillah. It may have been written by his students. It may have been some combination thereof. But there seems to be, some good reason to believe that at least it's an expression of the Vilna Gaon's approach to the Megillah, even if it doesn't capture every one of his words, because right, he didn't publish the book. Okay, so I just want to give you a couple of samples to give you a sense of his moral vision, his Kabbalistic vision, and his interpretive vision of the Megillah. A few examples. Jump in with me in source number 10. So the Megillah starts, and you have the Megillah at the end of your source sheet if you want to just refresh your memory about the first few psukim. So the family of Elimelech, the Megillah tells us, Vayavoste Moav Yusha, that they came to Moab and they were there. And it's bizarre. By Yusham, they were there. Obviously, they came to stay Moab, they were there. So what does the Gra say? He says, Rotze lomar ki chol lichasam eretz Yisrael haya al shahayu tzare ayin ba'aniyem v'halchu l'moavim shahayu gam kein tzare ayin. He says, the whole backdrop of this story is that these were stingy people who didn't want to be generous with their money. And so they left Israel to be among people who are otherwise not generous with their money. That was the reputation of the Moabites. Right? They had an opportunity to help the Jewish people and give them bread and water, and they failed to do so. He says, as a result of their stay, the Yusham, you know what that means? They became like the natives. Okay. Point number one. Point number two, and this is actually famous. Your kids, your grandkids, they know this one because they teach it in school. But just to give you again an inkling of the Gra's interest in gematria and words and symbolism. Source number 11. V'shem ha'shenis Rus, okay? So the second daughter-in-law is called Rus. So my Rus, so what is that? We don't know that name, right? So he quotes the Gemara in Brachos. Just jump for a second to source number 12 so you can see the Gemara. So he quotes the Gemara in Brachos. Rus, my Rus, what is that? Amar b'yochanan shezach sabiyatzmenu David, sherivahu la'kodesh baruch hu b'shiros v'sishbachos. So it's a play on words. Why is she called Rus? Based on the conclusion of the story, because she's the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. David HaMelech, Sherivahu LaKodesh Baruch Hu, he like inundated, he flooded, Sherivahu, we see that word, Resh and the Vav, and right? So it's the same root. He inundated HaKodesh Baruch Hu with song, right? Because he was the author of Tehillim and the redactor of Tehillim, and he was the master of song, Rivahu, so she's called Rut. Back to source number 11, the Vilna Gaon. Amri Yochanan Shazach Sovyatzim in Udavit, Rivahu, Kachbarach, Mashiach, Yishbarach. He says, Lufiza Iker Chaser. He says, there's something missing here. It doesn't make any sense. She'ein kan shum remes b'ma Rivahu. V'yo ser tov likros ashir. If the whole point was because, she was the grandmother or great-grandmother of David HaMelech, and he wrote all those songs, so you know what her name should have been? Shir, or we would say Shira. Why is she called Rut? It's the wrong pickup. Shirivah LaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Shira, so call her Shir. That's also a name. So he says, Achein Hatam Shnikras Kenu. He says, I'll tell you what really is going on. He says, just do a little math with me. When we meet her, she is obligated in seven mitzvos because every Noahide is obligated in the seven Noahide laws. Then she converts. It's supposed to say, how many does she pick up when she converts? An extra 606. What's the gematria of 606? Root. Resh is 200, Vav is 6, Taf is 400, add it all up, 606, right? So so she picked up, Ruth tells you how many additional mitzvos she adopted in the course of her lifetime. Wow, what a symbolic meaning to this name. As an epilogue, he says, Ach, Kadesha lo tikshed lefisa havele likrosa, Tur. So what really should you have called her? Tur, right? So that would be the way you would write the gematria, right? 606. So alze amrina shezach sviyatzim enu David shirivah lekodesh baruch b'shiros. So that's what the Gemara means. It was just right. You had to know this background. We wanted to get right. We knew it was going to be the letters with tav and vav and resh, and we just didn't know how to organize them. So based on the fact that it relates to the word riva, so now we organized it. Beginning with the letter Resh, and you get Resh Vav Tav, and now you understand the meaning behind the name Rus. Okay. Let me just share with you one or two more comments. This one I picked because it's emblematic of a larger appreciation for Israel, specifically, like a Weltanschauung about Israel. So this is source number 13. So if you go back to the first chapter of the Megillah, so after all these deaths and tragedies in the life of Naomi, so she finally decides to pick up and go back to Beis Lechem. So just if you have the source sheet, so just flip to the back for a second so you could see the pasuk. Okay, this is pasuk vav, perek aleph pasuk vav. Vatakam hivachaloseh vatashav mistei moav. So she picked herself up, she and her two daughters-in-law, and they decided to return from Moab, right? They're going to leave Moab. Why? Ki shama bistei Moab, because they heard in stei Moab, ki pakar Hashem esamo laseis lahem lach, that the famine was over, that they had heard that Hashem had given his nation food. So listen to the Graz interpretation of this line. He says, Hainyan, and this is right, even though the Gra wasn't big on the study of philosophy, this is his philosophy, or at least a portion of it. He says, "Ki kol hatov hanimshach la'umos ha'ulam hu bishvil Yisrael." So a major theological point. He says the world sort of turns on the axis of the Jewish people, and the good that flows to the other nations of the world flows through the nation of Israel. Right, because the whole, right, and this is sort of foundational to his life philosophy, the whole of the world was created for the benefit of the Jewish people. Says, if just left to their own devices, the world should be desolate because you have all these no good nicks and these evildoers and these wrongdoers. And again, the world would just be tova vo if left up to them. Vayomer Elokim Yehor, God created light. Ze masem shel tzadikim. So what does the light refer to? So the Kabbalistic interpretation, Midrashic interpretation. The light refers to the deeds of the righteous. Rotzi lomar bishvil Yisrael, the righteous members of the Jewish people. Or maybe all of the Jewish people are righteous. It's all about the Jewish people. And from the goodness of the Jewish people, everything else follows. And where does the good of the Jewish people come from? That flows from the land. Right? This is amazing. This is 100 years before Zionism. So, right, you didn't need Zionism to appreciate the land of Israel, right? The Gra, encapsulated all right here. So, right, God's eyes are on the entire world, but they're specifically, from beginning to end, always on the land of Israel. So now back to our pasuk. He says, let me explain it to you. They're returning from Moab. What does that mean? He says, why did they leave? They had a mistaken conception. Elimelech thought, if we leave Israel, we'll do better. And now Naomi finally figured out that's not the case. She finally got it. She finally chapped that the real benefit in the world comes from the land of Israel. It was a mistake. What does that mean? That she heard? Not that she heard, like, oh, she got a newsflash, famine's over. No, no. Gras is not what it means. Kishama. Rotze lomar, havina. Doesn't mean she heard, it means that she understood. She finally got it. Havina biosasham, when she was there, when she was outside the land of Israel, kipakara shemes amovu yeto elis aseis lambach. she finally understood that the benefit of the benefit accorded to the Jewish people by Hashem, that's going to come in the land of Israel. Right? And who's going to be the beneficiary? The Moabites. Because it all starts from Israel and flows outward. There could only be an end to the famine in Moab when there was an end to the famine in Israel, because it all starts there. Okay. Let me leave you with one final comment of the Gra. I'll just summarize it in the interest of time. You have it here in source number 15, and then I'm happy to stay on and entertain any questions. I know we packed a lot in. One of the great lines of the Megillah, and you can see it in the back of your packet, chapter 1, verse 18, Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud Ches. Naomi and Rus have this back and forth. They have this dialogue, and Naomi says, "What do you want to go with me? I have nothing, and why would you want to return?" And Naomi gives this, and Rus gives this amazing speech, and Naomi finally relents. So after the speech, right, wherever you go, I go, your God is my God. Verse 18, Vatera ki mit ametes hilalechasita. So we would normally translate that as, Naomi finally saw that mit ametes, she was stubborn, right? She wasn't going to let go. And she was attached to the idea of accompanying her. So Vatechtal, she relented, she stopped trying to convince her not to come. Naomi let Ruth accompany her. The Gra rereads this pasuk, and he says, there's an ongoing battle between the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. It says, as a general matter, if your earthly body desires to do something, and again, I just want to give you some kind of exposure to the Gra's kind of orientation toward the bodily world and his interest in asceticism. So his conception is the following. He says, if the human body is interested in something and it comes easily to the human body, he says, chances are that is the influence of the Yetzer Hara. And if it feels hard and you have to overcome it, so that means that it's probably the right thing to do. Like that's the orientation. So he says, with that background in mind, he says, I'll explain to you what this pasuk means. So if you jump three lines from the end of source number 15, he says, "V'afkan eina yecholah lelech achareha, af shehis haisa b'chora mimena." He says, you know what it means? The pasuk means v'ater ki ment amet zatzil aleches ita. She was like stuck. She was stuck. Rus was stuck. Rus wasn't able to make it. Like she's not able to make the journey. It's too hard for her. So the Gra says, as soon as Naomi noticed that the journey became difficult for her daughter-in-law, even though she's so much younger and it should be easier, bilti amitz begufi yagi rabba, except with great exertion, right? The only way she could do it was to exert herself. At that point, az v'tzachtal im noasami amitzvos ki akavami atzar hatov. That's what tipped Naomi off, that really there are no ulterior motives here. She must be doing it because it's the right thing to do. And at that point, she relents and lets Rus join her on her journey back to Beit Lechem. It's almost, right, a total subversion of the text. Because it was so difficult for her, that was the tell. That's what gave it away for Naomi. And she finally understood that this is the real deal. It wasn't the speech, right? It was the fact that it became difficult. And when something is difficult, right, that's usually a sign that it's a motivation of the Yetzer Tov. Okay. I'm going to stop here. Obviously, on any one line, there's so much more to say about the Vilna Gaon and his extraordinary contribution to the Jewish people. Maybe I'll just, if I can find it, I'll leave you with one quote. I don't think I put it on the source sheet, but there's a, if I can find it, I'll share it with you. But there's a quote from Etkes where he says at the end of the day, here it is. He says, more than anything else, it was the Gaon's image as a symbol and example of exceptional excellence in Torah study that established his position in the collective consciousness. So we hold him out to be the icon, the paradigm, the model, because he did it all. He was the master of Torah in the entire corpus of Torah. Right, and that's what created this enduring legacy, where every school kid knows Torah giant, the Vilna Gaon. Right, those are synonymous. So we'll stop here, but I'm happy to stay on and take any questions or comments. And once again, thank you so much for a wonderful series.